Today, it's Edwin's Monday Evening Property Rant. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. Edwin's back for another Monday rant, and the good news is that Edwin has fixed the microphone problem. His audio is back to normal, so we should have a much more clear conversation today. Edwin, welcome.
Yeah, for that whinging bastard David in Panania. Yeah, that's you, mate. Whinging bastard. Had to get a fix. I got a fix.
And without saying too much, we can say that it was a user operator error at your end.
Hey, that, well, at least Dusty fixed it.
You're great. Anyway, look, this is a big week. Lots to talk about. But let's go headlong with your main news.
Yeah, look, like I said, we're going to break the news and on the DFA as we do breaking news. So look, as I've sort of been alluding over the last few weeks, we've launched a new role, and we're glad to announce Century 21 Buyers Advocates has launched with head office Charles Tarvey obviously at the helm, and the rest of the management team there. It's timely to bring that equality and that equilibrium between the sellers and buyers. So you can follow me now. I'm back, and it's also forced me back on a lot of the other socials. So I'm back on LinkedIn. I'm upsetting a few people there already, and I'm also back on Facebook. So far, I've only got 12 friends. But look, here we are. So it's a new day. I think it's going to broaden the horizons for a lot of people that are wanting to get into the market. And I'm sure with the help of the Century 21 team and as I will be building a national team as well, we'll be able to help our followers and viewers. And as I said, across the board of buying, as well as looking for that rental accommodation.
Well, that's very good, Edwin, and congratulations. This is a big step, and it's a very important step. We've argued for a long, long time that people are significantly disadvantaged when it comes to trying to buy property. And, as we've said, you need the right skills and the right help. And so this is basically a way of democratizing that process and allowing more people to access that. And being linked with one of the biggest agencies is also very important too, right? Because they've got a really broad footprint. And so getting that sort of connected seems to me to be quite a powerful step forward, particularly in the current environment when there's so much disinformation and misinformation out there, and a lot of people are being deceived by the partial information that's available. So well done.
Hey, look, and as I said, this is going to be a big step. Obviously, it's taken me a number of years to think this through, and part of the 10K has come across. Others want to stay independent. But look, we feel it's going to, as I said, better position the buyers. So it's going to give us a greater scope. And also, it's going to give us access to tools that we, in a way, didn't have access. And a lot of the main portals are really offering those tools to the selling agents. And because the buying agents or the buyer's advocates in the role that we play now, that I'm playing now, is not a big contingency in comparison to the rest of the industry. We don't necessarily get access to, or a lot of offices, a lot of individuals work independently, and really they become unaffordable. But because now we're part of a bigger brand, and as you said, it is a global brand. They're in 186 countries, and Charles is taking Century 21 to UAE as well as India, and Gary is looking at branching out in other parts in between. So it's going to put a lot of those people that are looking at wanting to come back, expats, to look back closer to where they can buy, and get a feel for the current landscape, where it's put us, putting them in touch with us here locally. But again, for our followers and our viewers here in Australia, here in Sydney, as I said, it's going to give us a lot of access. As I'm pretty much a big advocate in bringing transparency into the industry. There are tools that even I didn't know existed because I've left the dark side, the selling side of things. I've left it 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, and since then there's some amazing tools that are on offering. Obviously, the offices have to subscribe to them, but they're powerful tools, which I've been saying all along, that the portals have got fresh data, timely data that needs to be sent out to everybody, but they don't. They hold it back. But guess what, folks? Through our network that I will be building, our followers and viewers will have access to that, and we could potentially have access to sales of properties within 24, at most 48 hours. Because when the agent logs it on the back end to take the property off the market on the back end, that data is now becoming available to all selling agents, and we're standing in there and we're knocking on doors to have that access to that to that part, so we could bring about that transparency, which I sort of looked at was looking at it, and the first person I thought about was you, Martin. In collaboration, I'll be able you'll be able to pin me an address, and I can pin you back the information as you do your one to ones with the people when they want to, when you look at areas granular and you do those conferences with them and those sit downs with them. I can, we've got access to that, which is great, which is really, we shouldn't have to fight for it as much as we do. But as much as you and I do, to have the people informed, but this is the world that we live in. Money talks, they say. So obviously, look, I will definitely, my team's all behind me. It's a team it's not just myself. It's a team that we're, moving forward with. So it's a collaborative effort, and we'll see how, which way it goes from here.
Well, that's great, Edwin. And yeah, absolutely happy to share information from my models. I have granular information and more than 2,000 postcodes, of course. In fact, tomorrow I'll be running my latest show, and that show will be the one where I actually report on the latest information. The show's 8 p.m. Sydney tomorrow, which is basically building off what I said recently, how real households are coping with the property pickle. Despite the hype, I think that's quite important. And just as a teaser for people, they might be interested to know that as at the end of September, you can see here the latest stress information, and you can see that just under half of households with a mortgage have cash flow problems. Unfortunately, the rental sector at 74% is still very high. So there is a really big, important issue here. And the more we can help people get more informed and make better decisions, the better I like it. And in fact, the better it is, particularly now, because when you look closely at what's going on in the marketplace, it is quite fascinating to really sort of peel it back a little bit. And when you actually do that, like this article, for example, when and where should you have bought a house? This is, of course, quoting the latest Catality figures. Darwin was the most affordable capital city with a median price of $558,600. But who wants to live? in Darwin? But investor activity there has doubled, though off a low base. And interestingly, the investor conversation continues with this post here, which shows that an investor has edged out competition to clench the keys to a grand Victorian terrace in Sydney's inner west for $2.91 million. Now, whether that was a first-time buyer, but I tell you what, Edwin, I've had a number of conversations this last week with prospective first-time buyers, even with the extra capacity post the 5%, they've still been outbid. And they've been outbid by property investors who are coming back in big, especially in Sydney, up in Queensland, and over in Western Australia. So what it says is that even with the changed atmospherics around the first-time buyer scheme, which I'm a bit sceptical of in terms of its real impact, the truth is that there is still a horrible gradient between investors and first-time buyers, and first-time buyers are still losing out.
this is what we've been saying. This is what I've been saying for many years, that the grants do not help the first-time home buyers in any way, shape, or form. And as I said, well, I've been saying it from the early 2000s and you know, from when they first started coming in. It has always and will continue to grease the palms of the developers, the builders, the flippers, and anybody else in between that wants to sell their property. It just inflates the values of property. It gives property a new lifeline. It gives shithead property a new lifeline, particularly in the different cycles where we've had a lack of supply. And the current cycle that we're in right now, where it's orchestrated lack of supply, and it's one of those things. We told you so. We know how this movie plays out, but yet the powers to be keep on thinking that this is a good thing. In terms of investors, when we started talking about some of the stuff back even just before the election, if you recall, we were talking about how the buy my vote policies, that's what I call these grants, buy my vote, and how the first-time buyers were, at the end of the day, we're going to be thrown under the bus. And this is when investors jump in, because we went so quickly, so rapidly, from the first-time buyer pool of 750 to 850 band to now we're up to 1 million to 1.2 million and this is incredible. We've seen in the last 2-3 years properties go up in value in certain parts of the Sydney region and in the extended Sydney region, almost double in price. And I repeat that, almost double in price, within a 3-4 year period, because of all the government policies that have been thrown at it, and from immigration to the buy my vote grants and all this sort of stuff. So this is what happened. So obviously, alongside that carriageway is you've also got the rental demand and the rental pressure. That's in there. So of course investors are going to jump in because they can see the values of the equity values of the properties that first home buyers would normally jump into. They start getting a greater return, and more so with the groups of people the blocks of people like your which are chatterers, your new kids on the block, and your silent tigers that move even further away from your traditional rental markets into more your budget accommodation scenarios, and they self-manage the properties to get a higher income. Well, it's a no-brainer. And this is what we have. And this is what we've been getting. So when you start seeing and hearing these stories of homes jumping up in value from just before the announcement of the 5% deposit, scheme to the actual inception. I mean, properties you and I were talking about even before the mainstream were going up in value by 50, 60, 75, 100, $125,000, where we could buy in certain parts of Sydney for assist our first home buyers. We were looking at 950 to 1,050,000. Now you can't touch those areas for under 1.2 million. And guess what? It's not. The scary thing is the fact that it's the lemons that are being released first, before the better quality properties. So yeah, but as you say, Martin, you can't paint the stories with the same brush, or you can't write it with the same brush, because on the other side of that, on the other side are also scenarios where people have bought, like the one that I've posted to you, where I came across the Evan on X, puts out there in that story, in a short story there, how from a 10-year investment or so, they end up they end up with a, you know, they pay $600,000 for an apartment, and they end up selling for $510,000, and you know, they're basically, you know, in a, you know, getting on in age, and obviously, and now their super fund is almost diminished. And why? Because, you know, everybody thinks that because the mainstream talks about, you know, the prices and the booms and the rises, they think that everything is going to go up in value. And this is a classic example that you've got to be very careful and very wise as to what you buy and what you approach. And now I've been reading other articles about the first-time buyers and how they're falling into those traps as well. And many, many first-time buyers, as I said, watch this space. Because from here on to the, you know, for the next 3, 4, 5 years, a lot of them have got no option but to move into the new high-rise developments, and their pain is going to be the stories of the 2028, 2029.
Yes, absolutely, Edwin. And just worth reflecting on the first own grant improvements. It's interesting the RBA came out and said that the house prices could go higher because of Canberra's 5% deposit scheme, which is interesting. And, you know, Treasury modelled a 0.6% over 6 or 7 years, but pretty much everybody else I've spoken to in the industry is suggesting that it's more likely to be 6 to 10% in the first year. And we're already seeing some of that already sort of working its way through. Interestingly, the other sort of angle on this is that the question of should you buy, shouldn't you buy, of course, is partly the question of the deposit, but it's also the question of serviceability. And of course, this article just brings that home. If property prices fall or interest rates rise, repayments can quickly become a strain, and negative equity when the mortgage on property exceeds its market value is a real risk. Mortgage repayments aren't the only additional cost to consider. Stamp duty, purchasing costs such as building inspections, conveyancing fees, ongoing costs such as council rates, strata fees for apartment blocks. Our advice is to treat the scheme as a leg up, not a shortcut. I think that's probably a good advice. The problem is a lot of people are not actually thinking through the full implications of the commitment they're making. And, you know, I don't know the particular case that you quoted in that earlier post, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was North Ryde Apartments. North Ryde Apartments are down considerably from when people bought a few years ago. Why? Well, massive supply, all the same, cookie cutter, strata fees going through the roof, and economically, people are losing money still in those areas. And I can also point to areas around Perth, by the way, where prices are still below where they were, where people bought in the previous peak. So it went up, they bought, went down, it's gone back up. But not
they're also hidden
far.
Fees, Mark. Yes. Yeah, there's also hidden fees. And look, the North Ryde story is not the only story. You've got Parramatta, you've got parts of Kempsey, you've got those areas there, Bankstown, Blacktown, and even in the south, around Campbelltown. So you've got Liverpool. You've got this sort with all the high rise the development and the investors, but a lot of people have forgotten. And again, this is one of the things that I used to talk a lot and write a lot about on LinkedIn many years ago, is the fact that the hidden fees that you're paying in those new developments, and that is you've got commissions, where you've got financial planners, and in this case, more than likely was a financial planner or accountant that persuaded these people to go into a self-managed super fund scheme and bought a property. I'm not saying that buying properties with a self-managed super fund, you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying that you shouldn't be leveraging, or you shouldn't be what I'm personally against. This is my personal opinions. I don't believe that a super fund should borrow to buy a property or borrow very little. But in many cases that I've known people in the industry of, you know, people who bought properties, you know, in high-rise developments in Melbourne, Gold Coast, and every other place around the place with 20% deposits, which is, and borrowed the rest. A lot of people don't realize is, as I was saying earlier on, the hidden costs. And the hidden costs are the exorbitant commissions that are being paid to
to financial planners, to accountants, to your properties brokers, marketers, they call themselves marketers. And these are people in the majority of people that are selling investment vehicles without licenses. And I've been very vocal about this, from the early 2000s. And this has been one of my bugbears for a very long time. And this is one of the reasons why I left some of the organizations, because they didn't like me voicing this, because the organizations don't want to, turn a blind eye to it, because a lot of these people are members of the so-called organizations that are meant to bring equity and clarity into the industry. But this is it. So when we're talking about, as let's say a $600,000 purchase of an apartment, off the plan, you can bet your bottom dollar that $60,000 to $70,000 of that goes out, by way of commissions or marketing fees to the parties that are selling it on behalf of the developer. And on top of that, the developer will inflate the price. Historically, many developers inflate the price as well, because they say, "Hey, if I'm giving you a huge commission, well, why can't I get a bigger, profit at the end as well?" So we'll increase the price overall. So that's how that game is played, and I've never really been one to get involved with that. But this is where we are. So you really got to be careful and be watchful where you put your money, whether it's for long term living purposes or investment purposes. This is the one of those many obstacles that you could really stumble on.
Absolutely. Well, buyer beware. Make sure you make the right due diligence inquiries on the way through. All of those things that we've been talking about. Mind you, it's not just the small guys who are actually feeling the pain. I thought this was quite an interesting little article when Trigonoff takes a $1 million haircut on Gold Coast apartment. Basically having to cut $1 million from his original asking price to sell a luxury two-level Gold Coast hotel penthouse at an auction over the weekend for a mere $11 million. So, even at the top end of the market, people are actually having to adjust their expectations somewhat as well.
Well, that's a consolation prize that we have, right? That even though I have to take a haircut every now and again, was it worth that much in the first place is the question. But Harry and his valuations, or the values that he puts on property are anywhere between 10 and 20% apart from reality. But hey, that's the machine that he's built. People get in, and he makes it easy for people to buy a lot of the stuff that he buys. That's the vehicle. People are he's there. The good thing about high rise is they may be slower getting things fixed in the strata complexes, but at the end of the day, he's still there. He hasn't disappeared like many historical developers that have come into a world of gaka and left buyers and investors hung and dry, and they've marched off to other parts of the world. That's the good thing about Harry. He's still there, and he'll be there for a long time yet. That's the consolation if you want to pay, as I said, so much above the actual value.
Mm. Well, actual value, of course, is in the eye of the holder, isn't it? Now, I want to talk about this a little for a moment, Edwin. Unit rents in Sydney hit a record high of $750 a week, according to this article. And it's interesting that the strongest rental growth for houses over the past year was in the North Sydney and Hornsby region, where rents were up 8.3% to $1,300 a week by September compared to a year earlier. And that's followed by Ryde, then the Central Coast, et cetera, and even the Northern Beaches. So there is a very significant issue here with regards to rentals still rising, particularly for houses, although units as well, as this article shows. And in fact, this particular one then makes another point in another article that rents have soared by 30% in one Sydney suburb and by double digits in a string of others as the cost to rent a typical property reaches record highs. And it's interesting here that they're drawing a little bit of a bow. Price hikes makes year's rent equal to a house deposit. So that's maybe a backdoor way of trying to persuade people to buy rather than rent. But as we said before, the issue is, Edwin, that when you think about buying a property, there are additional costs, lots of additional costs that you may not be actually taking into account. So it's not that simple. But then when you look further, there's also this article saying, well, no, it's New South Wales regional towns where the rents rose the most. Employment opportunities in remote corners of New South Wales are driving double-digit jumps in rental prices up in central Riverina region, for example. Greatest annual rental price of any LGA in the state. And median rents in the agriculture district by 21.4% over the 12 months of September. So that's a real big problem. And this article here just took it a bit further, which I thought was just highlighting the impossible problem for renters in retirement. So if you're marching through middle age and renting your home, the dream of retiring might look like a scrambled egg than a golden nest egg, because the trouble is that when you're actually moving into retirement, you've still got to pay those rents. And so there's an argument here that those in the rental sector are actually being significantly disadvantaged, not just now, but also later in life too. So this conundrum in the rental sector, which we see all the time, and I see it in my surveys, the rental sector is where the problems are. And I'm not sure it is as simple, though, as persuading people who are currently renting that now's the time to buy, because of this issue of trying to work out what the real costs are. But also, if you don't buy, then you've got a real problem as you move into retirement when your income goes down, but the costs of the place that you're renting potentially could continue to rise. So there's some real problematic issues here that are really structural in nature and have been created by 20 to 30 years of bad government policy, frankly.
Well, it's very difficult to make that decision in terms of rental. You're talking about, for starters, you've got to disassociate homes and apartments. You can't bring them all into the one, into the same mix. It may seem affordable for somebody that's renting and you're paying $1,200 a week in rent, but that's in a house. And you could say, well, then you could buy an apartment. But you're going from a four-bedroom house into a two-bedroom apartment, and you've got three kids and two adults, or three teenagers and two adults. But you've got to take all these things into consideration. Space, apartments aren't getting bigger. They're getting smaller by nature, by the constraints of the cost of construction, the constraints of the cost of the land. So they may go higher, but then as we were saying earlier on, then you've got the added costs to maintain and construction. The higher you go, the more it ends up costing you to build as well. So there's that side of things. So this is where those articles, you really got to pick them apart. You've got to using your terminology, go granular on a suburb by suburb and look at what's happening. You've got homes in certain in certain parts of Sydney, like for example your Hornsby, Asquith, those areas up there. You're not going to get much change. Your Barara Waters, you're not going to get much change out of $10 million for a three/four bedroom. Red brick home that was built in the early 70s on 650 square meters of land, but you could rent, you could if you're in Hornsby, you could rent you could buy a two bedroom apartment there for 750, but it would have a lot of issues, so these are the anomalies. These are the things that people really have to be aware of and take those stories that with a grain of salt, because once you start dissecting everything and looking at it, you've got parts of Blacktown that are King's Langley. They're already this year alone, there's been like four or five sales in King's Langley over $2 million per house. You could rent a duplex. Three, 4 year old duplex in King's Langley, between $950 and $1,050. So there's a lot of
a lot of differentials that you have to look at and be very, very careful. I think the unfortunate, it's as you also pointed out before in the previous podcast earlier this month, and that is that from the research that you do with your surveys and the untold story is the story that people are in rental properties, whether it be homes or your low set apartment blocks, your three story walk ups, or your four story, four or five story, reasonably well maintained apartments that were built in the late 90s that are very spacious. People don't want to move from those areas for various reasons, but yet they're absorbing rental rises that aren't being talked about or aren't being published because that's an internal document, internal negotiations post the deposits that are made into the rental bond board that most of the mainstream pick up from, and they would narrate the stories from that information, because some people have been in homes for 7, 8, 9 years and they can't afford to move because they've got to take the kids have got to commute a lot further if they want to, in order to accommodate and take commuting to the desired schools. They're established. You mentioned the elderly. The elderly is something that the government are going to have to seriously consider, either that or they're just going to have walk them straight into paddocks out in the bush, perhaps, or bring those cubicles from China and put them in some sort of farming grounds out in the bush, because it's becoming more and more expensive to get older, and because there's the facilities, the medical facilities, are more central to the are more in the central hubs, and the further you go out from the Sydney region, the more expensive it gets to get older. Because of the medical facilities and the specialists and that are just not there, so if you're a renter and you're going into that retirement age period, you're in a world of poo, because especially if you're no longer working and then you're going to be relying on government assistance, well, hey, your landlord's going to have something to say. And sooner than later, you're going to have to find yourself and your partner living further out in Whoop Whoop, and kind of get more expensive. It's really crazy. How things are unfolding, the government's got no idea what's really going to hit them in 3, 4, 5 years time.
No, I agree. When this is a real problem, and it's a structural problem, as I said earlier on, it's partly created by many years of bad policy. And people are trying to do logical things in response. But of course, as I've said on many occasions, household formation is older now. People are older by 10 years from where they used to be. They're buying their first property a lot later, if they can buy at all. More people are actually expecting to stay in rental through the whole life and retire with rent, which, as we say, is a real problem. And even those who actually do buy, when they go into retirement, will still have a mortgage. And that mortgage means that they've still got to service that mortgage, or they've got to sell the property and downsize when they actually retire. But then, as we've said before, it's very difficult because you can't find property in a similar area at a lower price to be able to move to. So whichever way around you look at it, it's real messed up. And there are no simple answers, but unfortunately, the government continues to, jaw rather than actually war this issue, and that's the problem. Interestingly, of course, also that buyers may be changing their preferences, and there was this article from the US, which was quite fascinating, which was that actually a new survey shows that more home buyers are willing to settle for less square footage and are instead prioritising wellness features, flexible spaces, and community amenities when house hunting. So there you go. There's a different strategy there.
Yeah, it's a different strategy. It may work in the States. I thought that was an interesting article nonetheless. And reading through that post and in the comments after that post, now that I'm a part of the global brand, I'm starting to follow global trends, but from America predominantly. So
But my question is, Martin, why doesn't that work here in Australia? Why? Yeah, it works. You may say that it's it works well in many parts of America because of the population. But outside of the population, there are other factors that that driving young families further out in the habit to commute and so forth. But why isn't that? Doesn't that work for us here? Is one of the questions that we need to research and to ask. What would you say your thoughts on that are? Why doesn't that sense of moving out into the region, why isn't it working? I've got my ideas. I'd like to hear yours.
So there's a couple of observations. The first is when I talk to people, they have quite significant expectations in terms of the size of the space that they want to live in. So if I compare the average square meterage in the UK, for example, with Australia, Australians just always had this idea of, I want big. It's just natural. You know, when I moved from the UK to Australia, I was amazed at how even smaller places in Australia were a lot bigger than places in the UK. So I think there's a natural, maybe we just have always wanted more space. The other thing is that when you actually think of moving further out, then you look at the amenities that are available and those that are not available. And I know that when I was searching to move out from the centre of Sydney, we were living at Cremorne Point, right in by the harbour. Beautiful property there. Views over the water and, quick, easy ferry trip into town, into the centre of the CBD, as well as the local shops. There were lots of local amenities there. When you actually move out into the regional areas, quite often you lose amenities quite quickly. And so for many people, particularly as they perhaps move into later stages of life, the quality of those amenities are important, but they're not prepared to give up on some of the other things like size and space and what have you. So what it means is that actually people aren't prepared to make some of the compromises or make the compromises differently than you might think. So I think that's part of it. But what do you think, Edwin?
Apart from that, and obviously there'll be many others, but one of my main things is I like driving out into the country towns, and I've done a bit of driving in my days. I think that nor the libs nor the labs really have had any passion for the as much as they say they did, but in real passion for country towns and regional towns. The move that you that you often spoke about, the move for in terms of banking institutions closing down the branches, so it makes it harder to develop the smaller towns that are in essence are a big part in the lifeline of the cities, and so when you start taking that away, and then you start taking away your commerce, your local shops, your local POs, your local post offices, and then pubs start closing down, and shit, when pubs start closing down, that's it. It's all over Red Rover. So it's that lack of structural infrastructure to give it a life of its own has lacked. Whereas, in my limited knowledge and understanding of America, obviously population plays a big part, but there is a bigger drive there, in a lot of parts for the township and that growth. Whereas here, both parties are hell bent on bringing everybody to the city. Perhaps it's because it's a political thing. It's more vote than a natural development of the nation to make it more sustainable. And hence the reason why a lot of the young people also don't want to travel out to the further than the regions than the regions as we know it, as they know it. When you start even talking going over the mountains,
they start turning their eyes, rolling their eyes, and whatnot. But because as you know, everything that in their world is in the main centers, of all the cities. When you start cutting down or decimating the townships, then obviously industry stops, and it's not going to grow. There's no further need to grow that town. So it just dies a natural death, people start commuting closer and closer to the central hubs. That's mine goes back to that. Goes back to our 2020 range on all roads lead to Sydney. It's been orchestrated for a very long time. That's the sad part. This is where, for us, moving to the mountains was, it's been a blessing in disguise in many ways. Yeah, I drive a hell of a lot more. I just think again, and if I need to be down in Sydney earlier, I have to beat the traffic. I have to get up earlier or avoid the traffic, come home later. But in terms of it's a lifestyle change, that has brought about a lot of sanity into the insane world that we currently live in.
Well, I agree. Yes, I certainly enjoyed my time down the coast in God's own country in the Illawarra. A little bit more sane than in the middle of Sydney. But of course, there were some limitations in terms of the local facilities. You'd have to go down to Wollongong, which was quite a reasonable drive. And in terms of some, for example, medical treatment, you had to go up to Sydney, which was 2 hours there and back. 2 hours up, 2 hours back. So, yeah, it just shows you get trade-offs. And I do think that in the US, there is a bit of a different philosophy. Obviously, there's a bigger population density in some areas, which helps as well. But I do think we've got a major problem in Australia. And in fact, I made a show with Robbie over the weekend when we highlighted the fact that the two major parties are all lockstep with the banks. The banks are pulling all the strings. And the banks, of course, want efficiency. And that means putting everybody, in the main urban centres. Well, that's in line with some of the planning ideas from the government as well. We'll build up in these major urban centres. Interestingly, in the UK, they've now announced about 10 new town projects. In other words, taking and building a whole new area, including schools and other facilities, and a lot of housing, of course, but not just bolting little pieces on to existing place, but creating new communities. And I think that's really interesting that they're doing it in the UK. Now, whether they'll be successful, who knows, but they're actually identifying a number of areas. And they're looking at things like connectivity to transport links and accessibility of infrastructure. But it's a very different idea from what we're seeing in Australia. The whole idea of creating new communities over the mountains and elsewhere and actually enriching those, that's not happening. It's going the other direction at the moment. I think that's a really major policy flaw in the Australian context. In fact, I remember sitting in front of Tania Plibersek and a few other people years and years ago talking about the idea of creating new towns in Australia, to create momentum away from rather than pulling momentum to just the main urban centres. And it was like I was talking, a foreign language. So there you go.
You do talk a foreign language, Mark. that funny accent of yours.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
just a last point on that. It's really bizarre the fact that people are actually looking at options of going to the ghost towns of Japan, where they're a trillion miles away from the main. From the main cities, and they're traveling, to establish and build a new life, as the article say, in Japan, going to country towns. What does that tell of what the government policy has done to the mindset of people? I mean, seriously, if you're going to go to a country town, they prefer people, Australians are preference in going to Japan to live in those ghost towns than they are to, you know, to commute, you know, further inland from Orange. And you know, that's that says to me, that just tells you how bad policy has been for so long, that people are, you know, taking that those steps. Next thing, and tell me people are going to go to bloody Zimbabwe and find better to country towns in Zimbabwe.
Well, yes, the globe beckons, Edwin, the globe beckons. Now, let's just talk about the latest kerfuffle in Canberra. Of course, Jim Chalmers was rolled out today. Albo, of course, being on holiday at the moment, and Chalmers had to back down, basically, on his plans to apply the idea of taxing unrealised gains on superannuation. So he sort of fudged a bit of a solution here. I think this is hilarious. It rather reminded me of a naughty school kid being told to go out and own up while the teacher was away, sort of thing. Albo is, of course, overseas at the moment on a holiday or something. And so Chalmers came out. And I regard this as quite a major victory, actually, because, of course, they were really pushing very hard, for 2 years plus, saying, well, you know, we want to tax unrealized gains, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, this article from Phil Kerr is quite funny because, they're talking about the government couldn't secure the passage of the 3 million super bill. During the dying days of Parliament in 2024, it was tried repeatedly. It failed. Reputable people such as Philip Lowe, Ken Henry, Allegra Spender, as well as Paul Keating, has condemned it as bad policy. And in this term, Albanese had all the enthusiasm, a wet blanket, towards Chalmers' post-election economic roundtable, and the PM's paw prints are all over the super backdown. So they've basically backed down on the idea of unrealised gains. Well, that's a very, very good outcome in my view. Shows the pressure of public opinion. It was always a worrying policy because it opened the door then to taxing unrealised gains on more than superannuation, stocks maybe, or even property maybe. So that's a good thing. They've obviously done a few little twiddles around the corner to basically bring another band at 10 million with a higher tax take. And they've also done some twiddling at the bottom end to try and actually help people on very low incomes because they've been a disadvantage. But I thought this Roe cartoon just had it beautifully. Well, what's happened to your pants, Jim? They've been indexed. I love it. So there you go. It just shows you the power of pressure and, you know, never give up, because the politicians have a habit of doing dumb things. You know, the cash ban, that was defeated, and now the unrealized gains defeated. So that just shows that the power of pressure from multiple sources can ultimately have an impact.
Hey, look, I'm going to go a little bit further than you, Martin. I'm going to say that it was going to affect would-be politicians as well, and their investments were potentially on the line as well, and you can't have that. So it might be internal and external pressures all around. But there's a lot of people that were rooting for it can now go and out take a cold shower because it ain't going to happen.
There is another
election cycle, around the corner. So hey, all sorts of promises are going to be thrown out at depending on what the biggest building voting block are going to be.
Yeah, well, I have to say I was listening to some of the press conference and I rather felt Chalmers was doing his, spin even faster than normal, trying to actually justify this backtrack and this U-turn. Didn't do it very well, actually. And I have to say that I was quite amused. I think you've probably put your finger on it, though, Edwin. Of course, too many politicians would have been actually, having to pay more tax, and we can't have that, can we? So, you know, you've got to find a different way. Oh, very good. Well, we should just move on to the numbers, I suppose, just before we finish off, and we'll just look at Sydney to start with. So on the 6th of October, 22,315 property listed as defined by domain in the Sydney region. Week later, 22,823 on the 13th. And in Melbourne, 27227 on the 6th and 27506 the week later. So there's a bit of a different move in terms of Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah, look, we said last week there was almost triple the amount of numbers that came on market in Melbourne than they did in Sydney. Sydney more or less has a buzz of about 500, and so does Melbourne this week. But the interesting point there is that Melbourne's not slowing down. There's a lot more, and I believe this, as I said, a lot of the articles, the narrative over the last 4-6 weeks, and also on YouTube feeds and a lot of paid advertising on other social media platforms. My God, LinkedIn is I now realize why I went off LinkedIn as well. There's so much shit. So many selling agents want to peddle their properties and their investment in to other agents. Overall, I look at the trends and I see that they've been pushing so hard. But look, if you're an investor, I still think this is, again, my personal opinion. This isn't financial advice or any way, shape or form. And that is that Melbourne's still got a bit of a way down to go, because there's a lot more policy coming on. There'll be more policy around taxes, because the state is pretty much broke. And that's the unfortunate thing. And also this waywardness of the community, the young community that aren't going to school, and all the gang warfare and everything else is just scaring the crap out of people. But more importantly, the small business operators are just being throttled. And like I said at the beginning of last year, watch this space, because a lot of that industry, the small industry, is going to come to New South Wales. And I mentioned back then as to what areas we're going to explode in price. And from then till now, some of those areas that I pinpointed in terms of industrial estates, in terms of warehousing, the land values have gone up significantly. And I'm talking, in some parts by up to 35%, which is huge. Why? Because of the tenancies that have been coming over the border, and there's going to be a lot more. So when you've got all that happening, you're going to get a lot more properties on the market, and a lot more investors are going to be continue to bail out, because that's a shame. Yeah, what was a great city on par, if not in many ways, it started superseding what Sydney was as well. It's turning into a badly managed strata complex, like the ones you see, like your million dollar ghettos that I used to talk about, about 10 years ago. So it's sad, and I'd say that we will clock the 30,000 listings on market, and won't take long.
Yeah, very good. Well, I think that's right. And again, quality of listings, not great, a lot of lemons. And again, I've had a couple of one-on-one conversations this last week with property investors in Melbourne who are still looking to get out, because the fact of the matter is they can't make it work. The rules and regs that have now come in, the small returns, the little or no growth in price over the last few years, all of that working against them. And they're looking at other places and thinking, well, maybe I should cut my losses and then go and invest in another centre, Sydney, up in Queensland or Western Australia. We'll just look at Brisbane briefly. So on the 6th, 3,232 properties. Week later, 3,309, so a small rise. And just looking at the auction numbers, interestingly, the auction statistics were a little bit down this week in terms of the overall numbers, although the clearance rates were sort of around there. But and I know that the clearance rates don't really tell you very much. But interestingly, if you compare this week with the same time last year, you can see that last year there were considerably more auctions than this year. So you can see that we are still in the situation where the momentum in the auction section of the market is way down.
Yeah, so sentiment
sentiment's down. I mean, we have reached another peak level of pricing. The show that's put on by auctioneers and selling agencies isn't really bringing in the new listings, isn't really convincing the locals in the areas to sell, because a lot of properties have been sold prior to auction or get passed in at the on the day. So there's, you know, it's a number of things, but and more importantly also, as Charles Tarby and Ray Ellis said when I was down in the conference in the videos that I did with them, and that it is, you know, people have got nowhere to go, which is what you and I have been saying for a long time, is, you know, where do you go when you sell? Again, we go back to, okay, if you're an empty nester and you're going to retire, you know, 30, 40 kilometers away from your grandchildren? I don't think so. And so you stay put. You know, we haven't seen a huge ramp up in renovation. We did earlier on, but we haven't seen a huge ramp up because of the restriction to costs. But I'd say that there's a lot of the old, you know, the bigger homes are now occupied in lots of the areas of Sydney by, you know, two, in some cases, three generations. And, you know, because of the lack of stock. And that is what's also driving a lot of markets in a lot of city region, city areas, city suburbs.
Absolutely. And just on the clearance rates, I just want to quickly show you this. This is the Domain story. So 71.3% in Sydney, 73.6% in Melbourne, nationally 70.6%, right? So that's what they are saying. And then when you look at the Catality, you can see there that they're saying 73.9, 73.5, and overall combined 73. But of course, the SQM data, now this of course is actually a different methodology, but it's a more accurate methodology, right? This is to the 5th of October, because it takes them a bit longer to put all the information together. They're at 53.1%. So there you go. There's a big difference between the two major people who are reported in all of the mainstream media and what we're seeing from SQM. And the point I want to make, Edwin, is that this week in the AFR, there wasn't an article over the weekend on the booming auction clearance rates, because they didn't boom. Very interesting, right? So when there's no news or there's a lower result, they just don't write an article about it. So I think that's quite an interesting observation in terms of the way to think about this. And I've said, and you know, you say it as well, I think, that you can't look at these overall aggregate numbers and make anything sensible out of it at all. It's just wallpaper, really. It's just a way of getting clicks and whatever. And the truth of the matter is that at the end of the day, what we do know is that the real story is not what's happening in the auctions. The real story is what's happening on the street. And again, important to go granular. Now, let's just quickly look at the rental data. So this is the rents for Sydney region on the 6th. 9750 went up to 10,042 on the 13th. In Melbourne, 11,217 on the 6th and 11,767 a week later. So just a little spike up there, but nothing very much to see. And again, I would highlight the fact that the average asking rent is still rising. It's now starting to accelerate again. And of course, more people who are living in property are still being confronted with significant rises as they come around, and almost always have to end up paying, because the alternative is to try and find something else, which would cost probably more. So as we come to the end of the show, you've got a very important little tip for us all.
Yeah, look, it's an oldie but a goodie, and it goes, it keeps on going around, and that is don't get caught in that emotional windmill. All that emotional slipstream, as many do at auctions and when you're negotiating with property. You need to set your limits early, whether it's a private treaty, and a lot of the private treaties or a lot of the well-presented properties end up being Dutch auctions, as I call them, or, you know, silent auctions. They're not posted as auctions, a private treaty, but then, you know, the agents end up auctioning the properties by way of getting up. Getting less than final offers
to present to the owners.
But yeah, in a lot of cases, not in all, but in a lot of cases, the warning goes out and that buyers are being played. You've got to set your limits early. This is a conversation. I'm sure the people won't mind me sharing this because I've taken out their names anyway, and also my conversations with the agents and the offers that they received. I know on one of the properties that we've been trying to purchase, and part of our role, as a property consultant is to help our buyers that we're representing, help them keep the temperature down, and not inflate the prices of the properties that they themselves want to bid on or buy, or make offers on, because when we sense that there's a level of emotion, or when we sense that the agents are playing us, we just got to sit back, because there's no point, I say this with warning bells. Don't get involved in that emotional windmill, because the other party will always will get more emotional, and they will outbid you. And all you've done in the process, in the meantime, is you've inflated the price for that property, but it's inflated the price for the area or the street that there are one or two people looking putting the properties on the market. And guess what? They're not going to want. Let's say, for example, they're not going to want 1.3 if the neighbor sold for 1.4, but the houses are really only worth around the 1.3 mark or the 1.32, but because the emotion took it all the way to 1.4, now all of a sudden, guess what? Everybody in the area sets the price of 1.4. So that's that's the emotional price. That people pay, and the worst case scenario is when a lot of people pay that emotional price on properties that they haven't done the due diligence, and they do it on a lemon, and it ends up costing them $100,000 to $200,000 on the other side to fix, not to renovate, but just to fix the issue. So the last thought that I want to leave there is when you've got an emotional buyer, or in some cases buyers, I can guarantee you one of them is prepared to sell their firstborn in order to get the property, and you will be priced out. Some will drain the bank account and the parents' bank accounts. Others will sell, do that and top it up with the firstborn, and that's just a fight not worth having, in my opinion. Especially if you're looking in those areas. As I said, part of our role is to help our buyers, our clients, to be cool, calm, and collected, because psychologically it also gives you that edge when you go into the next negotiation, because you're going there with, chest raised, head up, because you're not going to fall into the trap that many agents are playing.
Yeah, very good, Edwin. Well, thank you for that, and congratulations once again on the Century 21 Buyers Advocates. That's really good news, and I look forward to hearing more about that in future shows, and I look forward to seeing you back next week for another rant where we can go into the stupidity of property, but also the opportunity of property if you know what you're doing, because it's all about getting the right advice, going granular, and not getting emotional about it.
100%, man. 100%. You have a great week, and stay well.
See you next week. Thanks. Bye-bye.